Andrew is an associate professor in the Redpath Museum and cross-appointed with the Department of Biology, which he joined in 2002. He earned his PhD in 1998 from the Department of Fisheries at the University of Washington. He then went on to a postdoc at UBC from 1998 to 2000, and then a second postdoc at the University of Massachusetts, Amherst, from 1999 to 2002. Andrew was a recipient of his PhD work. He was recipient of the American Society of Naturalists Young Investigator Prize. Most recently, he was a recipient of NSERC's Stacey Fellowship. He's an incredibly productive researcher with more than 120 publications to his name. And he's also co-chair of the Biogenesis Program of Diversitas. So Andrew is making a number of important contributions to our field. I think the one he's probably most known for is this idea that ecology and evolution interact reciprocally, and that it doesn't make sense just to say that ecology only makes sense in the light of evolution, but of course that evolution makes sense in the light of ecology as well. And finally, a few years back, maybe 5 or 6 years back, on our first field course together, Andrew and I had a long and heated debate about whether we should apply evolutionary biology for the sake of conservation and for understanding the impacts of humanity. And we did that in front of many undergraduates. And he took devil's advocate position that we shouldn't be wasting our time with conservation biology or worrying about evolutionary principles for saving the planet. I'm happy to see that he's changed his mind, and I'm looking forward to what he has to say. Andrew.
So it's true, I'd kind of forgotten about that debate, and I was thinking I was going to get through this whole introduction without being roasted in some sense, but he just set me up to roast myself, because in the context of that debate, I was playing devil's advocate saying, you know, Barbados is just toasted, we don't even need to worry about conserving it, and I really was being devil's advocate. He got way better teaching evaluations than I did in that course. That's the worst teaching evaluations I've ever gotten. So I learned my lesson, and I've decided to entirely dedicate my career to applying evolutionary biology and my things to conservation biology, partly so that I'll get better teaching evaluations. So the talks you saw so far today are essentially ecological talks. And that's great, and all of them also invoked an evolutionary history, an evolutionary context for the organisms that are involved in the interactions that will be changing in the future. In addition, evolution will have an important role in the future, and that's the perspective that I want to bring. So I want to stop taking the idea of these species being static entities that have an interesting evolutionary history that has an important influence on their current ecological interaction, but also to ask how are they going to be evolving in response to these environmental changes and the effects that that will have on communities, ecosystems, and biodiversity into the future. What I'm essentially doing is I'm giving an advertisement and an introduction to the importance of thinking about ongoing evolution, contemporary evolution, rapid evolution, when considering biodiversity science problems. So I'm going to ask, I'm going to give this very basic general introduction that I hope will serve to stimulate research rather than to answer any particular questions. And I like to start thinking about this problem by thinking about penguins. Now, when I say penguins, you have in your mind, I hope, emperor penguins, you know, with their eggs on their feet in the middle of the Antarctic winter. Organisms, vertebrates anyway, that breed in the coldest environments in the entire world. But remarkably, penguins also breed in one of the hottest terrestrial environments near the ocean in the world, and that's the Galapagos Islands, right on the equator. So penguins are found north of the equator, just barely, but they are north of the equator. This means that penguins, these archetypically cold-adapted organisms, are also really heavily warm-adapted. And when you think about that, that means that penguins as a group are capable of adapting to the most dramatic environments that we can present to them in the immediate vicinity of the ocean. Now that suggests that in the context of something like climate change, that perhaps evolution can accomplish all sorts of changes that will enable populations to persist in situ, or to move to places where they're better suited and to adapt to those conditions. So perhaps then that means that evolution is going to solve all our problems. And indeed, biodiversity into the future will ultimately be an evolutionary problem. The reason why organisms might go extinct is because they're not adapted to the new conditions. So thinking about that becomes a realization that evolution and its success in matching organisms to environmental change will be critical for considering biodiversity. Of course, the important point is that the rate of change is occurring so rapidly now that organisms might have more difficulty than if that change had occurred on more geological timescales. So this, of course, is stemming all from Charles Darwin's insight, and the basic idea that we have for many, many decades, almost a century after Darwin, was that evolution was a very slow thing. So if you take some just general quotes from The Origin of Species, here's a classic one: we see nothing of these slow changes in progress until the hand of time has marked the long lapse of ages. Similarly, she can never take a leap, she being natural selection, but must always advance by the shortest and slowest steps. So until very recently, this is what we thought of evolution, so we really only needed to consider evolutionary history, not evolutionary future and evolutionary present. But I just wanted to sort of break that that assumption by first pointing out that I'm not sure that's what Darwin meant, because it's hard to discern just how rapid he thought evolution was beyond those statements which have no rate associated with them. But there's one place in The Origin of Species where he puts a rate on evolution, and that's in relation to the single graph in The Origin of Species that shows evolutionarily dividing trees and lineages. And in the context of this graph, he says, after 14,000 generations, so each of these steps is 1,000 generations, six new species marked by the letters N14 to Z14 are supposed to have been produced. So here he has said that within 14,000 generations, you have the origin of six new species. And within each of those 1,000-year periods, there's tons of diversification that's taking place, and some of those cases, it's causing the split of two new species in a very short period of time. So in my opinion, I think Darwin thought evolution was actually rather rapid. Now, presently, we think it's even more rapid than that, and the co-discoverer of natural selection, Alfred Russel Wallace, really had what amounts to the modern insight. For example, here's a quote from Wallace: "There seems no difficulty in an amount of change quite equivalent to that which usually distinguishes allied species, sometimes taking place in less than a century." Darwin and Wallace thought evolution was rapid. It's pretty cool. Now, we know that this is certainly the case, and there are many, many examples of rapid evolution in response to environmental change, particularly with respect to human influences where we're trying to kill things, and they evolve away from our efforts to kill them. But I don't want to focus on these. Instead, I want to take it into the biodiversity context by asking about rapid evolution in the wild and what are the consequences of that. Now, there are many organisms where it has been shown that evolution occurs on relatively short time frames. So we're talking centuries. Here are just a few examples of some of the organisms that in the 80s and 90s were demonstrated to be showing rapid evolutionary responses. And so what I want to do now is I want to ask about the consequences of that evolution for the future of biodiversity in a human context, in the Anthropocene. So for those of you who aren't evolutionary biologists, and really that is the purpose of my talk, is to introduce these evolutionary concepts and to make them seem interesting to people who aren't evolutionary biologists. So let's just take a little bit of a background on how one might think about the role of evolution in environmental change. So imagine a simple situation where you have some phenotype. It could be anything: body size, breeding date, any trait you care about. And there's some relationship between that and fitness, survival and reproduction, such that there's some phenotype, body size, breeding date, that's the best breeding date or the best body size. And in situations like that, we expect that a reasonably well-adapted population will have its phenotypic distribution that's centered under that optimum and is relatively contracted around in the center of that optimum. So that's a well-adapted population. Of course, the real question is, what happens with environmental change? Environmental change amounts to shifting the optimum to a new location. And you can imagine this in two contexts. One is where you have an abrupt shift in the optimum. So you basically just move the best trait away from where the organism currently is. So the introduction of a new pollution, or maybe the introduction of an invasive species or something like that. So in that context, all of a sudden, evolution would favor you being over here, but you're over here. So what that means is that there's a gradient of fitness in the direction of the new optimum that crosses the population here. Individuals on this side will have higher fitness than individuals here. And as a result, all else being equal, you would expect the population to evolve to the new location, assuming it does not go extinct in the process of doing so. Or you can have a more gradual shift in the optimum, such as in the case of climate change, where the optimum moves along and the phenotypes follow it, and the population will persist as long as the demographic cost of that evolutionary change does not get so high that it causes the population to go extinct, even though it is in the process of adapting. So now organisms can achieve this, basically improving their match between their phenotypes and the environment represented by some theoretical optimum, in several ways. One is you can simply move to a new location. So if the best conditions are now over there or further north, well, you just get up and fly, swim, or walk further north. So that's fine, but of course, in an increasingly fragmented world, that's often not possible. So you might have to stay in place, but change your phenotypes to suit the new optimum in the way that I was illustrating before, so that's evolution. Or perhaps as an individual, you can shift your phenotype such that you're now better suited. So if it gets warmer earlier, just make a personal decision to reproduce earlier. So all of these things can play an important role in matching organisms and their phenotypes to the new conditions. The one that I want to spend the most time on, of course, is evolution, because that's the only long-term permanent solution to this problem. So in the rest of my talk, I just want to give you some quick examples of the role of evolution within populations, some real concrete instances where this has been shown, something to sort of hang your hat on. Then ask quickly about any generalities of that trend and the particular role of human influences. Are humans doing something special, or are they just another form of environmental change? Then just transition from evolution within populations to the process of diversification. And then, depending on time, get into some evolutionary rescue ideas and ask whether or not evolution can save populations from extinction. Okay, so I just want to give you some nice examples so that you can see that this is a concrete phenomenon. It's been demonstrated in a number of instances. But I want to start with natural variation, because it is true that although humans are having these big effects, environmental change might be causing rapid evolution even without humans. And perhaps the best example for that, or at least one of the best known, is Darwin's finches on the small island of Daphne Major in the Galapagos Islands, so staying with Galapagos theme. And this population was studied by Peter and Rosemary Grant, who started their careers at McGill University. Now, what's been shown by tracking this population over a long period of time is that you have evolutionary changes in the size of the beak that correspond to particular environmental changes. So this red increase in beak size is highlighted here, and that occurred when a major drought as a result of La Niña conditions caused plants to stop reproducing, reduction in seed availability, which meant that only the birds with the large beaks that could crush the remaining large seeds were the ones that survived. So they passed on large beak genes to the next generation, and you had a rapid jump up in beak size. Evolution can occur rapidly, even in natural contexts. But we're really interested in some of these more global contexts, or at least in human influence contexts, one case being global warming. Now, there are many instances where phenotypes are shifting in response to environmental change, but there are relatively few of those where it's been demonstrated that change is evolutionary. Here's one of them, and that is red squirrels in the Arctic. So it's been shown that the date of reproduction is becoming earlier and earlier by a substantial period of time, 20 days here, over the span of only about 10 years. Now, this entire population has a pedigree. So using analysis called the animal model, you can determine the particular component of this change that has a genetic basis. That is, its evolution. Here's a representation of that. This is essentially the genetically determined breeding date. And you can see that it is also shifting earlier as you go across the generations represented by this time period. They are evolving to breed earlier. in addition, individuals are deciding to breed earlier too. So it's a combination of those bottom two effects, that is, individual plasticity and evolution of the population as a whole. So this is a rather diffuse human impact. It's, we're causing climate change and things are evolving in response. But we can have much more direct human impacts as well, with a well-studied case being trophy hunting. So in this case, the example I want to give you is from a place called Ram Mountain in Alberta, where there's a very small population of bighorn sheep. And people, mainly rich Americans, pay good money to go there and shoot trophy rams. Now, they're only allowed to kill rams where the curl exceeds, goes past the eye, which leads to very strong selection against individuals with the that are the fastest growing and have the biggest horns. And so you can see, over about a 30-year period, there's a dramatic decrease in horn size in the population. Moreover, this population is again pedigreed, so you can do a trend like this, but only for the genetic component of horn size. And that looks something like this. So you see that the genetic horn size is also decreasing through time, showing that there's been a dramatic amount of evolution as a result of this direct human impact on the population. Things that might be of even more importance to us, because, you know, none of us are going to go and kill... Is anyone intending to go and kill sheep on Ram Mountain? No? Nobody? Anybody intending to eat fish in the next few months? Yeah, there you go. So now here's something that we might care about, and that is fish harvesting. So in a similar sense, humans are often killing large amounts of fish population, large amounts of fish, and they're often killing the biggest fish. And so it's been shown that during the dramatic increase in harvesting and then the decline thereafter to essentially the moratorium, where the fishing of cod, you've had the evolution of body size in this population. And this is simply showing the size of the fish at a given age, and you can see that from the 1960s to the 1990s, it has decreased. Cod of a given age are now smaller. And we showed that this is a general phenomenon across multiple different fish stocks and populations, such that the higher the rate of fishing mortality, the more rapid the decrease in body size. So humans are having a direct evolutionary effect here as well. Okay, so I just gave you some concrete examples, which I hope illustrate the fact that there's really strong evidence in a number of these instances that evolution is shaping the population in real time. But perhaps I cherry-picked examples, as Jonathan was pointing out, that people often criticize. And yes, I did cherry-pick examples. It would give nice, clear instances. However, we can also ask more generally about this. And we can do so by calculating an evolutionary rate for phenotypes in a standardized metric. So this is equivalent to a Cohen's effect size. It's the amount of change in standard deviation units, in this case, in generations. And we have a large database, much larger than I'm showing here, where we've quantified rates of change from the literature and asked how rapidly populations are changing in response to a variety of environmental disturbances. In particular, I want to take the time to ask whether humans are having a different effect than more natural contexts. So we can roughly divide populations into those that are clearly being impacted by human influences and those that are not clearly being impacted by human influences, and ask which ones are changing more rapidly. So let's do that by plotting the amount of change in relation to the number of generations. And I'll give a single data point for each study system, and I'll code them by blue, which is natural environmental disturbances, and red, which is human disturbed context, with the idea being perhaps that the red dots will all be higher than the blue dots. So for starters, we can see that that's precisely the case. So the red dots represent something like 9 of the top 10 values, and overall you have a more dramatic amount of evolutionary change, phenotypic change, when you have humans getting involved. Humans really are doing something extra. But perhaps that influence is not consistent across various human influences. So we've seen rankings of whether invasive species are most important or whether habitat loss is most important. But what's most important for human influences on evolutionary change? I would argue that the most logical situation is that where humans are having a direct influence, so they're directly harvesting populations or trophy hunting, will be where they're having larger influences in evolutionary change than the more diffuse influences like climate change. So let's take a look at the same type of analysis where you have the amount of change by time, and then let's ask whether or not different types of human disturbances lead to more dramatic changes. This was analysis done by Chris Darimont, who's now at UVic, and you can see that when humans are acting as a predator, so hunting and harvesting, that's when you have the most dramatic changes. So when humans are actually out there killing things, harvesting them for fisheries or trophy hunting, that's when organisms are evolving the most rapidly. Nonetheless, the blue points, which are other human influences, often exceed natural levels of variation as well. And Vincent is going to be telling us if this holds up using new analyses. Okay, so what I've done so far is I've told you that populations are evolving in response to human disturbances. But biodiversity is more than just the persistence of that which is present. It's also what's going to happen to the formation of new biodiversity in the future. So what I want to do now is I want to transition to a consideration of the ways in which humans are influencing not only the evolution of individual populations, but also the process of diversification itself. Now, the first obvious way that happens is that they cause extinctions. But what I want to ask more about is the more subtle effects that are evolutionary. So, with an obvious example, taking the Darwin's finches, showing each one population evolving, now we're asking about the diversification of one form into multiple forms. And in order to do so, I'm just going to give a conceptual framework along with representative examples. I need to sort of generalize this concept of this adaptive landscape and how evolution will occur in environmental change to multiple dimensions because it allows me to more easily illustrate the different possibilities. So I showed you before that environmental change shifts the optimum and hopefully, anyway, the population evolves along in response. Now, instead of thinking about one trait, let's just think about two traits. So you have these two dimensions being the two traits, and fitness will now be coming out of the screen at you, represented by the intensity of the color. So here's an adaptive peak in two trait dimensions. So the blue, higher blue is higher fitness, and it declines to all sides, just like that in one dimension. Now, just like in the case above, you would expect that the distribution of phenotypes here in black will be somewhat close to that optimum and decline on either side. Environmental change, just like in the one-dimensional case, shifts the optimum along and the population evolves in response, if it persists. Now, the reason why I wanted to present it in these two, in these multiple dimensions here, three dimensions, is that it allows me to more clearly illustrate the idea of diversification when you have multiple peaks. So now we're talking about two peaks out there. And really, that's where we think most biodiversity comes from, the adaptation of organisms to different peaks in the landscape, different niches. They evolve to have different ways of using the environment and influencing the environment. So in that case, we expect that in general, organisms that are out there are reasonably well adapted to different fitness peaks. Those different Darwin's finches with those different beaks, they are presumably sitting on different fitness peaks corresponding to food items for which their beaks are best suited. Okay, so with this framework now, we can just ask quickly about several different ways in which humans can influence this process. Now, one thing they can do is they can eliminate one peak which can lead to attraction to a new peak. So for instance, here's one population sitting on one adaptive peak, but there's another adaptive peak out there somewhere. And if you lose the one, what you expect is that the population is now on the domain of attraction of the new peak, and it will potentially evolve to that new peak. Now, in the case where you have another location where the old peak is still behind, You've now created two divergent forms, one on the old peak and one on a new peak. So a nice demonstration of this is where you have populations introduced to new environments. So invaders are great. Come on, Tony. Invaders are great. They increase biodiversity in the sense that they diverge from their ancestors in their original location. There are many, many examples of how an invader is not the same thing from its native range to where it gets. Instead, it evolves in response, enhancing overall global biodiversity. He knows I don't have enough time. If he starts debating with me now, I'll run my talk over and you guys won't have lunch. Okay, so there are many cool examples of this. I just want to give you one. These lizards that were introduced to a bunch of islands in the Mediterranean. And one thing that's really cool is that on some of their original islands and on the mainland, they eat mostly arthropods. But you put them on these other islands where arthropods are scarce for some reason, and they end up eating mostly plant matter. As a result, they evolved a whole bunch of traits which improve their ability to process plant matter. They bite harder, and they've evolved cecal valves in their digestive system which slows down the transit of food through their gut. This is actually incredibly remarkable because these cecal valves are not found in that entire lizard group. They're found in a very different lizard group, which suggests that there might be macroevolutionary events occurring in just about, well, less than 100 years. So in this case, invasions can create new peaks. You can introduce things to new locations, and then they adapt to new environments. An alternative is that you introduce a new peak that does not change the distinctiveness of the old peaks. So you introduce a new plant to a location. So for instance, you get a new peak there, and if the conditions are right, you see that the original population can bud off and form a new type on that peak. So you've increased biodiversity by adding a new resource to which something adapts. And there's many cool examples of this with new insect host races on introduced plants. So there's literally hundreds of examples of this. When someone introduces a plant, native insects colonize it, evolve a new host race, which in many cases is reproductively isolated from the native host race. So you have the origin of a new species within roughly 100 generations. There's also a cool example from the London Underground. So in 1859 or so, they built the London Underground, which is coincidentally the exact date that Darwin delivered his manuscript for The Origin of Species. And I like to think that he delivered it on the Underground. You know, he rode the train in, then he caught the Underground and went to the publisher, John Murray. And on the way, a mosquito latched onto him and went into the Underground, flew off into the Underground, and created an underground form of the mosquito. It is now shown that these underground-derived mosquitoes are reproductively isolated from the ancestral above-ground mosquitoes, so they're really a new species. Once again, really rapid evolution of increasing biodiversity. Of course, biodiversity is not always enhanced by humans, so you can introduce a new resource that messes up the distinctiveness of the old peaks. And when that happens, everything can fuse back together, and you can lose biodiversity. So we've been studying an instance for this, back to Darwin's finches again, where in 1968 you had two different forms within a species, and with the advent of humans and humans feeding them rice and a whole bunch of other foods, you've lost that distinctiveness into the present. So by humans introducing a whole bunch of food types for the finches, they broke down those original associations that led to that diversification and caused species that are beginning to form to fuse back together again. So traits can change rapidly in response to environmental change. Humans drive particularly rapid trait change, and humans influence diversification. I just have a couple of minutes to point out that we don't know in this case. So the first part was trait changes. The second part was the evolution or loss of forms. But do these trait changes matter for persistence? So that's the idea of evolutionary rescue, where you have some environmental disturbance, the population size declines, and it might go extinct or it might recover, with evolution perhaps making the difference. So as the environment shifts, the population declines, they evolve increased adaptations, and then recover. That'd be evolutionary rescue. And of course, one of the best examples for this is from the work of Andy Gonzalez and Graham Bell in the laboratory, where when you expose yeast populations to heavy salt, they decline, and then they evolve out of the problem. And you can investigate the various things that influence that effect. We've done some of our own work in nature by asking about how quickly fitness traits evolve in nature. Now, I'm not going to show you that because I don't have time, but the essence of it is that evolution on a short period of time can increase the survival prospects for introduced guppy populations by a substantial amount. So 50% improvement in your survival prospects for individuals as a result of adaptation to new environments in experimental introductions in nature. But really, if we're going to do this properly, we need a whole bunch of lakes with species in them, and we let some of them go extinct, and then we ask, what's the difference between the ones that went extinct and the ones that didn't go extinct? Obviously, that's an extremely difficult experiment to do in nature, but I do think it's theoretically possible, and it really is what we need to be doing, because if we want to know if evolution really matters and what makes it matter or not, we need to do this kind of experiment. So I just want to conclude by saying that populations can respond adaptively to environmental change. Humans can cause particularly rapid changes and can influence diversification. Adaptation can sometimes aid population persistence, but we need more data. And the key point, the take-home point, so wake up, okay, because this is the only point that matters. Evolution now matters for biodiversity later. Thank you.